Well, according to my watch, it's now 6:00. We have a quorum.
Oh, we do, great.
So let's get started. First item, second item on the agenda, roll call, would Secretary please call the roll?
Committee member Bicot?
Here.
Bruzy?
Here.
Cromer?
Here.
Gillen?
Here.
Hobson? Rivera? Roberts? Solly? Strong? Volin?
Volin.
Volin? Chair Stuckey?
Here. Thank you. Public comments, any? Do you have any public comments that have been sent electronically?
No.
No, okay. And there's no one in the back has any comments to make at this stage. So I can go for action items. First item is the approval of the minutes for April 14th meeting. Hoping everyone has had a chance to review those and any comments, questions, amendments, revisions? Is there a motion?
Motion to approve.
I'll second this. Mr. Bowman seconds. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously. Next item, committee chair and vice chair for the fiscal year coming up. We're actually just started. Does anybody have a nomination to make?
I'll second that nomination.
I'm sorry?
Second the nomination for you to remain chair.
All right. We have a nomination and a second. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
That's good, thank you. Now we need a vice chair. Anyone willing to step up?
I am, I just got reappointed for 4 more years.
Okay.
I can hang in here with you guys for a while.
So you're volunteering to be vice chair, is that what you're saying?
I second that.
Second. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, congratulations, John.
Thank you.
Next item, discussion regarding the annual report of activities and authorize the chair to work with staff to finalize and submit. Everyone had a chance to look at those? Is there anything missing that ought to be there? Anything that's there that shouldn't be there? Has anybody read them? Staff did such a perfect job, there's no changes necessary.
Do you see any?
Remember that number. Okay. I guess we need a motion to authorize the chair to work with staff and make that presentation to council.
Some move.
Mr. Cromer move. Second, Bowman second. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. By the way, welcome, Mr. Cromer.
Thanks, sir. Nice to see you.
Next item, the annual report for the measure A. Excuse me, committee. Again, this is for the previous fiscal year. And let me correct what I earlier said. This is the one that will be presented to council. Again, this is a recitation of those items that we discussed in past during FY21 fiscal year. Again, does anybody have any additions, subtractions, amendments? Nothing. Okay. I guess we need a any motion on this? Well, this is recommendation, recommend for presence.
I guess it's the recommending presentation to the city council.
Yeah, is that before our motion? I would assume not, but if someone wants to make a motion to recommend the presentation of this to council, I'll be more than happy to entertain it.
I'll make that motion.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Baldwin. Anybody want to second? All right, thank you. Any further, well, I can say further, we haven't had any discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
I'm not opposed. Can we be notified when that presentation can be made so we can attend? I think it'd be nice if the board members were there also to show our support for it.
That's easy. Announce that.
Yes, the secretary will notify the committee when it's scheduled for the council meeting.
Okay, great, thank you. Item 4.5. Consideration of proposed amendment to add special assignment support positions to the fire department measure rates expenditure plan.
Yeah, so I was going to offer a presentation to go with it. Sorry, I think you came in late, just in case you need that. There'll be a couple slides there. So good evening, and thank you everybody for being here. I know this is a commitment for everybody, but it's always a pleasure to meet with you because the commitment is noted, and we're thankful that, at least speaking on both on behalf of the two public safety agencies, your participation is really welcome, and you offer a lot of good insight and challenges along the way, and that's important. So. As you saw in the packet, we have an item to add some staffing to the fire department. We worked with finance and identified that there are revenues on the fire department side of Measure A that were available for us to look at our staffing and look at what we're doing as an organization and find some efficiencies and better effectiveness to make the fire department function better. And so in particular, So in particular, looking at the expenditure plan, like we've always focused on, really trying to achieve some goals that we identified in our efforts in getting Measure A at least to the ballot, and then once it was in the ballot, figuring out what are the staffing needs to help us meet response times, and that was really our focus, is how do we elevate our service delivery. And one thing that we didn't do at that time is look at the organization and see what the impacts are to our personnel. So we obviously have made some really great ground on our performance metrics and our service delivery to the community, but now what we're starting to recognize is we've had some pretty tough impacts on our personnel and our staffing. And really what it comes down to is our personnel are becoming fatigued. They're working long hours. They have unpredictable schedules. And it revolves around our ability on a bunch of things, and a lot of those items are identified in the staff report that was in the agenda packet. And so I really wanted to kind of go into a few of those items and talk about them with the group, make sure there's a full understanding of what our staffing issues are, how we're trying to correct them, and try to ensure that there's a good understanding of that. So our staffing difficulties. So as you can see here, there's several things, and these are all identified in the staff report. We've had an increase in retirement frequency. Like retirements in the past 10 years have been at best one per year, and now we're looking at averaging it between 5 to 7 per year that we've seen in the last 12 months. And we're also forecasting that for the foreseeable future, let's say the next 5 years. In addition to that, we're seeing a lot of workers' comp injuries to our personnel that are taking a long period of time for our folks to be diagnosed, treated, and then rehab. And what's happening is when our current staffing model, when we have a member that can't, or a fire department member that cannot be at work and working in a fire station, then we have to backfill that position with overtime. So it creates this vacancy. That our other uninjured personnel have to fill beyond their regular duty days. Next is we're seeing what I'm calling a shift in the workforce. And this is me quoting other professionals in the fire service, and we're seeing this actually across the country. It's not just unique to Chula Vista or unique to the fire service in California. It's literally across the country. And what it is, I think the current generations that are entering the workforce are looking for a different work-life balance. Like they're valuing their time off a little bit more than maybe the opportunity to work overtime. So there's less people raising their hand to voluntarily work overtime, so that pool of people that are raising their hand is diminishing. And so what's happening is we're, because of our staffing models, because we need to have a certain number of people on duty every day, that means there's people that are working today and there's a vacancy tomorrow, and they are gonna be told, you can't go home till tomorrow. You need to come and stay at work. The next one, the second to last bullet, this is a little bit more complex in the fact that for our organization, as we're growing, we're adding fire stations. We just added one a little over 2 years ago. We have two more stations on the forefront. With Measure A, we've added a significant number of firefighters. So what's coming with that is kind of a lag, and it's a lag in adding administrative staff and training staff to keep up with those new demands. And it's historic. It's been that way in our organization for decades. I think it's probably true with most organizations that have, you know, a significant growth spurt. And so it takes us a little bit of time to kind of catch up to that need. And so how we react in the Chula Vista Fire Department is when we do have these administrative tasks and needs and these training tasks and needs, we start to lean on our fire station staffing personnel because they're competent, capable, and willing to assist the organization. So we'll pull them off the floor. We'll pull them out of the fire station to go take on these administrative and training tasks. And so when we do that, we pull them out of the fire station, that means there's a vacancy on their regular duty day, which gets filled with overtime. And so it's just creating and adding to this long list of bullets of creating vacancies, creating the need to fill with overtime, and it's creating this larger scale of fatigue on our workforce. And then finally, the last part, we have a 12-month onboarding timeline when somebody does, you know, raise their hand, you know, I've done my 30 years, or they're ready to retire, and then that triggers the need to replace that person. And so 12 months may sound like a long time. Just about 2 years ago, it was up to 18 months. And so working with HR, we've been able to really trim that down and get it down to this small time frame. This is small to me. So it may seem like a long time, but it is at very short. You take about 5 to 6 months to do the recruitment and the hiring, and then get them into the academy. And then the academy takes another 5 months to get them trained and indoctrinated to the City of Chula Vista, the Chula Vista Fire Department. And really the goal is we need to have turnkey firefighters once they do pass the academy, so that we train them all up front to avoid the same type of thing that's happening in the upper bullets. Meaning, when I came on the job, I was sent to a really short academy, several weeks. And then I spent the next 2 to 3 years going and taking the additional training that I needed to become fully qualified and competent in my profession. And what that did is, as I was being sent out to the training, that created vacancies, which need to be filled by overtime. So we're shifting away from that. So we need turnkey firefighters to come out of our academy. So with that, we have these special assignment proposed positions. There's actually 9 of them. There's 4 fire captains, 2 engineers, and 3 firefighter paramedics. That make up this special assignment component as far as positions. They're suppression or safety personnel. Some things that kind of drove us this direction, in addition to what I mentioned there before, I talked about the overtime and the fatigue and being force hired. So really what has happened is we've studied over the last 3 years, we have this ongoing increase of force hires. So each year it's getting worse and worse and worse, meaning employees that are with the department now are working more and more force hours, not just to volunteer, hey, I'd like to work overtime, but no, you can't go home tomorrow type of hours. In particular, like a firefighter's atypical schedule is 56 hours a week. They fall under a 7K exemption in the labor code, and that's what allows them to work 56 hours as opposed to 40. There's a special compensation in there, we call it FLSA pay, that covers that 16-hour overage. But as you can see here, when we look at our organization, we look at the number of hours worked, that average out work week has gone up to 77 hours per week. So you can imagine the fatigue, and this is based off of 3 years worth of data. So you can imagine 3 years of you're logging in 77 hours per week when you show up to work. Other things that have kind of pushed us this direction is along the way, we've had difficulties in staffing apparatus. So we will send apparatus to neighboring agencies to help them with larger fires. And when we do that, we need to call a crew back to backfill a company that went to help a neighboring agency, because that's part of our mutual aid system, meaning when we have a large fire, we're calling those resources to come help us, and they show up to help us. So it's a reciprocal piece. We need to play that part. So with that, what will happen is we'll need to backfill that crew. And so when we pick up the phone to call our department members to come in and fill those vacancies, sometimes it just doesn't pan out. And so we wind up shifting on-duty resources to cover the gaps, and we wind up short-staffed for the day, whether it's the entire rig is shut down, or maybe the rig doesn't have the appropriate number of staffing attached to it. And then finally, I think I beat this up pretty good, is the administrative and training needs. Again, falling back on that, as a growing organization, we're leaning on our fire station staffing. We're pulling them out of the fire stations to do these assignments. And really what it boils down to is when we look back over the last 3 years, we use approximately 18,500 hours worth of overtime to accomplish these tasks. And so when you do the math, that works out to be just shy of 9 FTE positions in the fire service, and fire department. So that's how we came up with our 9 and really analyze what the needs were. Okay, so I'm missing some words up there. So this next discussion point is based on the other two positions. So in the staff report, the total ask is for 11 positions. 9 of them are what we just talked about. That's the safety fire suppression side of the house. But we are also asking for 2 additional positions, and they're civilian staff. So the first one is, I apologize, I'm not sure what happened to that bullet. The first one is asking for a senior application support specialist. So that's a position classification that's already within the city. It's typically related to information technology services. And so what we found in the fire department is that we're relying on approximately 25 different software applications that we use through all of our divisions. So whether it's suppression, EMS, prevention, administration. And so we need support for those positions, or support for those applications to keep them functioning, to keep them running on our devices, anywhere from our phones to our iPads, our mobile data computers and our response units. And the way we're accomplishing that task right now is we're using some firefighters that happen to have some background or knowledge about these systems, and we're using them to accomplish this task. It's just the way we have kind of grown into these different technologies and supported them. And the problem with that is, we're using firefighters to do ITS related activities when we really need them to just focus on doing the firefighting. And so that's really the goal in this, is that we're trying to pull the workload off of the fire station floor personnel and put it to a consistent, knowledgeable, one point of contact that can really connect the dots on all of our applications. And then finally is logistical support. So logistically, as the fire department has grown, we've had an increased need in supplies, which means purchasing, ordering, receiving, warehousing, distribution, all of those things coupled into really having an effectively supported organization so that our firefighters can focus on fighting fires and running medical aids. One thing to note is that with our new EMS and transport system, we did bring on an additional position that's focused on this type of work, an inventory control specialist. And we assumed that we would be able to handle that new workload with that one position. And so what we realized is that was a bad assumption, and so we're reacting. And so where this is coming into place is that the ambulance transport system paid for that one position, and we kind of shifted some of our fire suppression needs onto that position, and they're just not able to keep up. So really the ask here is to add another inventory control specialist to focus on the fire suppression side of the house and support, you know, those needs. One thing I wanted to mention is that, to put it in perspective, before the ambulance transport system came into play, our warehouse was processing about $250,000 to $300,000 a year in supplies, and now we're up around the $1 million mark. So you can just see the massive impact in our warehouse. Oh, there's my bullet. I'm not sure what happened. I butchered the PowerPoint. So the next couple slides, I've made some handouts because I really wanted to try to focus on making sure that everybody on the COC understood our staffing and our scheduling and how these force hires come about, like, just to try to make sense of it. And so through our analysis, just to kind of put things straight, the fire service has two general staffing modes or methods. One is a constant minimum staffing, which is if we have one fire station with one fire engine, that takes 12 firefighters to staff 7 days a week, 365 days a year. There's four people on duty every single day. Constant staffing means you just have four people. The other method is supplemental staffing. So maybe you would hire 14 people for that fire station, and you'd have two additional people that would fill in for vacation or sick leave or injury leave or whatever that might be. Years ago, it was studied, and what we found was that over time, you're paying 1.5, right? The salary, the premium pay. But when we looked at an FTE many years ago, it was 1.8 for an FTE. So it was cheaper to run constant staffing. So that was the model we gravitated to, and that's the model that we're still exercising today. I'm not here to say that we're still at 1.8, but it's more than 1.5. So my number is 1.6. I think Ed would challenge us on the budget side. There's some other things that play into it. If it was super easy and complicated, we'd be able to shell that number out really simply. But right now, from a budgetary perspective, it's about 1.6. So it's still cheaper to run overtime. So it is it's a viable and functional method to staff a fire department. So with that, here's our example. And just for perspective, right, Chula Fire Department has 10 fire stations. We have 12 response companies. And so those 12 response companies has four firefighters on duty every single day. So to keep that up and running. So let's just say that we all work at Fire Station 5, which is by the South Library. We work at State Fire Station 5 is Engine 55. Again, it's got four firefighters on it. And as you can see on the right side, to make sure that it's staffed every single day for 365 days a year, we have three shifts, A, B, and C, red, blue, and green. And there's four firefighters on duty each day. This is what your calendar looks like. So if you wanted to look at, hey, when do I work? It's pretty random. So if you can't see it from there, hopefully you can see it on the handout, but there's three colors on there, A, B, and C. And this is just a 3 month snapshot. In reality, there's a pattern in here, and I'll show you a slide that tries to demonstrate that. That pattern is on a 24-day cycle. There's three different shifts, so they each have their 24-day cycle. It's hard to see by looking at this. It takes, I don't know, probably 20 years to be able to pick it out of a, you know, look at a calendar like this. But that's basically what it looks like. So here's where it comes into play. Let's use the example of we're all on A shift. That's the red days. And as you can see, we have red boxes highlighting that. And then where the circle is at, that's where that pattern starts. So the pattern starts on the circle day, and then 24 days later, then it starts again. But as you can see, you kind of work every other day for four shifts, and then you wind up having 4 days off in a row, and then you work four more shifts, or we call it a cycle, and then you have 6 days off, and that just alternates in that fashion. But as you can see here, in April, A shift works 10 days, in May they work 10 days, in June they work 11 days. If you carried this out for a full 12 months, there's a few months in there where you're only working 9. But for the most part, it's 10 days a month, 120 shifts a year. Right now, what we're experiencing in the fire department, and this ebbs and flows, like right now today, I wouldn't say this is 100% accurate, but this is pretty darn close. As soon as we start sending out strike teams, meaning out to the large vegetation fires, this is what a lot of our personnel will experience. And specific ranks do experience this, and they have been experiencing this for the last 2 years solid, and some even 3 years back. And so the yellow days that are shown up here, those are those forced hire days. So as you can look at this, if you're on A shift, April 3rd is the first day of your cycle, you show up to work. By tomorrow, let's say that was today, tomorrow morning you get a phone call from the staffing battalion chief that said, hey, you're being forced hired to station 10. So then you go to station 10 on the 4th, you work a 24-hour shift, then you'd be due back to your original duty station on the 5th, and then you repeat that cycle. And so typically what happens is you work your 4 red days, and then you work 4 more, 3 to 4 yellow days. So you're working basically 8 days straight, sometimes 7, but typically 8 days straight. Those are 24-hour days every single day, and you're not going home. Some stations aren't incredibly busy. Some stations are. They're running up to 20 calls a day, which basically you're up and moving 20 hours of the day on calls for service. So it is a significant impact. And so as you can see, if you push this out for 12 months, and not, don't get me wrong, our personnel will take a day off and they'll break the cycle, but then they're taking the day off just to break the cycle. They're not taking the day off because it's like they want to take a family vacation. It's really puts that grind on our individuals. So the last slide, there's a lot of information on here, and I apologize if you have questions on this. I would be happy to really grind through it. But what the intent is of this slide right here is to talk about how are we going to use these 9 special assignment positions. So as you can see on the left-hand side, we have those clear icons of firefighters. There's 9 of them. And then as you work your way to the right, we have 9 battalion chiefs, 36 captains, engineers, firefighter paramedics, and firefighter EMTs. And then as you work your way down below that blue line with the arrows on it, it's a little bit of a legend. So the black icons are seated positions. So those are positions that are in our budget, they have position numbers, and they are there to fill all of the positions, at the fire stations, to make sure that we are staffed with 4 firefighters every day on all of our 12 response companies. Then you'll see there's our clear icon with the special assignments, and then here's where we start to get some context. So the red icon is representing, remember I mentioned how we're constantly pulling admin and training assignments? So when we grab somebody off the floor, those are the red icons. So we're pulling them off the floor, and then meaning the floor of the fire station staffing.
So then I have a question about that. So you're actually pulling them out of the, and bringing them over to your administrative?
Basically,
they're not working in there.
Correct. Okay. So there's a hole.
Yeah.
Okay. Right? And what happens is we fill that hole, like if let's say that's the person we stole, we're filling that hole with overtime.
Okay.
So that's taking somebody, it's not their regular duty assignment, and they have to fill that seat because we need 4 firefighters to fill that seat. So as you can see, the average, right, was 9. That was the methodology of how we got to 9 in the first place. We had 18,500 hours. And that gets us those 9 positions. So in addition to that 9, we also have an FTE vacancy count. So those are the retirements. We've had a couple of individuals leave the organization. They kind of gave up on the fire service, but mainly retirements. And so with that, when we look back 3 years, it's kind of been a growing piece, but those vacancies have averaged in a 12-month period 8 vacancies per year for the last 3 years. So again, when those FTE vacancies are not filled, right, we're in that reflex time of 12 months to try to recruit, train fire recruits to then get them fully trained out to go and fill these spots. But our average per year, there's 8 vacancies. So, and then finally, the green icon is average long-term injuries. So over the 3-year look back, there's been 3 full-time for the 12-month period, open seats, so 6 long-term injuries per year. So when you add all these up, it far exceeds, right? It doubles, nearly triples what the 9 specialty positions are. And so we're, even this ask is probably not enough, but the reality is Measure A only has so much money in it, and we've pushed, Ed has helped us get to that limit as much as we can. So that's where we've really maxed out. That's where we're at today. So I hope that added some context of why we're asking what we're asking for, and you can feel comfortable hopefully supporting this request.
Open for questions?
Any questions?
Yes. So when you went back a few PowerPoints back, you said you were pulling people off that had knowledge of like your computer systems or whatever.
Right.
Have you thought of contracting for that? I mean, could that be a possibility and you could put those people back in the seat?
Yeah, it's a great question. So here's where technology is fickle, right? It changes really quickly and rapidly. And what we're finding is, I don't know if you recall, but earlier I mentioned it's about 25 different applications. So to contract the level of support that would be needed to like interface with our personnel, right? Because it's connecting the dots on, not that like my device won't turn on or that I forgot my password or my login credentials. It's the connectivity and the functionality that each application needs. So I apologize, and if I'm going too far in the weeds, you raise your hand and tell me to stop. But as an example, there's an iPad in the front seat of our ambulances. So that iPad tells our ambulance crews when they have a call. So they'll get a dispatch call screen that pops up. There'll be status buttons to say we're en route, we're on scene, we're departing for the hospital, we're going to this hospital specifically. And it provides routing information. It provides, if we're going to like an apartment complex, right? Some of the apartment complexes are gigantic. And so it'll give us a more detailed map and take us right to where the exact apartment number is. So to make that thing work, there's actually four different software applications that are all interfacing to make it function correctly. So one of them is, it's called Tablet Command, and that's what does all those functions that I just described. The next one is Telestaff, which is our staffing software. That's what tells the MDC, the iPad, who's working on that rig, so that, here's the crux for that. There's two things. One, it's an accountability issue. When we have large-scale incidents, and let's say something bad happens, maybe a traffic accident, or maybe they're assigned to a fire and they're there for medical support, and a battalion chief is managing the incident and something bad happens and they need to know who's working on what rig, that's the one device or method for them to verify who's actually on duty that day. And it sounds like that shouldn't be a big deal, but there's 24 response units in service every day. So for one battalion chief to know out of the 71 people that are on duty every day who exactly is on Medic 51, it can be really cumbersome, especially in an emergency. So if they're quickly trying to understand that. Then the other component to that is that we have to report on all of our activities when we do go to a call for service. So again, the same iPad needs to have Telestaff connected so that the report, when it gets generated in our records management system, it has the right people assigned to the call. Because there's several things that go into that. HIPAA regulations, we need to protect all the health information. So our records management system will only let the people who ran the call have access to the record. So it has to be all tied together, and it has to be tied in, because if myself and Nicole are showing up on duty that day, we go to our iPad in the front seat of the rig and we actually log ourselves in with our credentials, and it logs it in that day. So it's not that a staffing battalion chief is logging us in to work that day. We do it, and it's part of that security piece. And then the other, so right, that was Tablet Command, Telestaff, the records management system for our electronic patient care reports and our fire reporting is on Water. That's the name of the application, so that's the third one. And then finally, the fourth one, it all has to interface with our dispatch contractor, San Diego Fire Rescue, and that's Central Square. So here's four applications that all have to be firing on every cylinder behind the scenes, way way too detailed for people wearing this uniform to be able to troubleshoot, make sure it's working properly, and then when there is a problem, to be able to quickly know exactly who I need to call at what one of those four entities to get it corrected.
So, but you're saying right now that a couple of your personnel are actually making that work.
Yeah, yeah. So, one of them sitting right here. That's one of his daily jobs, is troubleshooting. So, yeah.
I appreciate that. I was just trying to understand how you got such an education on this.
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
And it just happens organically. It really is a great question. I was having the same conversation with the IT director today because he's new to the city and he's trying to understand how we're functioning as a fire department. And the reality is our personnel that work day in and day out riding on a fire engine, riding on an ambulance, they inherently have to become an IT professional because they have to be able to troubleshoot and communicate with all these different entities. And so those are just four of the 25 applications. And to move away from that complex scenario sounds like, gosh, why are we making this so complicated? But the reality is it provides such efficiency and effectiveness for our responses. It's the fastest way and the most effective way for us to do the work we're doing. So
that's what I was going to say, is just that 4 hours I rode with you guys, I saw that working, you know, with the four people. So
question, Chair. What is the financial impact on the fund, and where does that leave us with reserves, et cetera? I don't see much on the, I can see how much it cost us, but what is left and how does that impact us going forward?
That's a good one. So Emily Fulkers, our principal management analyst, she prepared the financial aspect to it. Your question, the way you asked it, I don't know if we really beat up what that does to the readers. I'll leave it to Emily to work through it.
Hi. So, sorry, my Wi-Fi isn't working, so I'm operating off my phone.
It's horrible in this building. It's horrible in this building.
Yeah. My phone hates me right now. So, essentially right now, there's a few moving parts. I don't know if anybody was at council on Tuesday, but our IFF MOU was just approved. So the numbers that you're seeing in this packet right now are what individuals are being paid right now. This does not include our IFF increases. However, we are working very closely with Ed, Sarah, and Maritza, who's right here tonight. And our ultimate goal is making sure our 10-year expenditure plan, we're flush, we're not going upside down. We're making sure that these increases in positions and these increases for MOU provisions and all that fun stuff, it's not having us go belly up in 2032, essentially. So in your packets, for the annual cost per FTE, so this is based on FY23 numbers. Again, this is pre-IFF increases. So for the 9 safety positions, there's a total impact of $1.4 million for FY23. In FY24, that's gonna increase because we're adding those last two positions. So in FY23, we're requesting 2 captains, 2 engineers, 2 paramedics, and then your senior application support specialist, and then the inventory control specialist. So that's equal to $1.4 million. There's around 7% if you average out all the different increases per the different salary adjustments for the MOU. It's roughly about 7% if you average it all out. So imagine a 7% increase to that $1.46 million. That is, we toyed around with all of our numbers. It is built into our expenditure plan where we are not going upside down in the long run. And then in FY24, you're adding those last 2 fire captains. And so then that has an annual impact of $385,000. And so it's broken down by fiscal year for current fiscal year and ongoing. So if you look at the larger table of proposed FY23 expenditures, the $8.7 million, that is with our current staffing today. That does not include any of our 9 requested positions to be added. Once you add in those positions, it has an updated FY23 expenditures of $10.16 million, which again, it keeps us flush in FY23. We accounted for different scenarios of salary increases when we were still in the middle of negotiations with IFF. We are still flush with our budget. And then in FY24, the addition of those last 2 captains, for $367,000, brings our total FY24 expenditures for those positions to $12.26 million. So I don't have the exact dollar amount of what our annual over-under is. I know we are over in our revenues versus expenditures. That was our ultimate goal working with Ed. He probably hated us at the end of the day just because we were constantly toying around with different scenarios, but it was extremely important to us that as we're trying to right-size staffing in our different operations, that we at no point are running upside down in our expenditure plans for our 10-year
At a budget, I think that's a wonderful explanation, but the way that the country looks what they're doing right now is interest rates are going up, purchases mm-hmm. are going down, mm-hmm. so it means that our budget is going to be not quite at what it's at right now.
Correct, which is why we also do have our reserves in place to account for scenarios like that. I'm sure we all remember our last COC meeting where we put our reserves in place. And so the fire department also, our ongoing activities do not rely on reserves or one-time purchases might tap into that, but as of now, we don't have any extravagant plans for that. So it is our goal to not be touching our reserves to account for scenarios like that, depending on what the economy does. Did that answer your question? Relatively?
More or less. Yeah. I think I could pull it up pretty quickly, get to the expenditure plan with these positions built into it. I guess the nuts and bolts of it, like right now we're about, with our current Measure A staffing, we're between $2 and $3 million under, like our revenue, our expenses are $2 or $3 million under our revenues. So, and then obviously the forecast is, and Mr. Pollan, you're right, the tax revenue is gonna start to taper off, but we're under the projections with this approach. And then the other piece that I would say with this, it definitely doesn't touch the reserves, meaning our fund balance on the fire department side alone is $19 million as we sit right now. So that easily covers, any concept of even looking at the reserves. And then the other part that I really didn't go into, but really those nine positions, looking at this FTE vacancy average, that's not gonna go down. And so, if you can bear with me as I go through this, as soon as somebody retires, our plan is to grab that one of those special assignment positions and drop them into fire station staffing. Like, we will constantly pull in those positions and dropping them into fire stations, because the goal is to improve their work schedule predictability, reduce the force hours, and ensure we have staffing. And so when we take that approach, our vacancy rate of those nine positions, we put in 8%, but I will be completely stoked if we're at 50%. Like, I don't think I'll be able to keep them filled. Hiring for the fire service is not like law enforcement, but it's pretty tough. Like, the paramedic qualification is a significant impact to current fire station staffing across the country, specifically in California, and even more so in Southern California. Our detriment is that we have Big Brother right to the north with San Diego Fire. There are over 1,000 firefighters. They have a significant need for paramedics to the point where they're hiring just good quality people, and then they're sending them to their own paramedic school. Then go further, a little bit further north, you have Orange County. There are about 1,500 firefighters, same issue. Go adjacent to them, LA City, 3,500 firefighters. They all have the same problem. LA County, 4,000. We're competing with really top-notch markets. So with this, we're having a hard time just filling these seats, let alone keeping those full. Like, we have an academy, right? I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful there's support from the COC for this, because this is going to create a better work environment for the fire department. And then once we go to council, I anticipate with your support, they would support us. I don't think we'll be able to fill those positions until September of next year. So even though we have this budgeted to start hitting this budget year, we don't have people to put in those seats. So we're going to be constantly struggling to fill those seats. It just helps us to be able to keep up with our attrition, help manage this impact, minimize this on the training and admin, and then minimize this impact on the injuries. So I wish I had better news on that front, but we're going to have
a... That begs a question, Kate, and that is, how are you going to find these people? Are they going to be lateral transfers, promotions?
Well, it's all entering from the bottom. It's our entry-level positions, so it's our firefighter EMTs and our firefighter paramedics. But it's the firefighter paramedics that are the hard ones to find. So we're doing extensive outreach to all of the paramedic schools that are local. So Southwestern College, Miramar College, or excuse me, Palomar College. There's a couple privates, EMSTA, and there's one more, I can't think of it. And then we're actually sending some firefighters to the San Diego City Paramedic School. It's a pretty steep price, so we try to minimize that, but the reality is we have really good quality people as our firefighter EMTs. We already know who they are, an employee, they're performing great. Okay, let's push them off to paramedic school. The problem is it takes 9 months to get that person back.
I mean, if you're going to hire four captains, it's over a couple of year period.
Right.
You can't do that at all from within, I wouldn't think. You're going to have to, you know, skill up to San Diego.
On the promotions, I think we're good on the promotions. It's really filling that entry-level piece. So, yeah, it's the entry-level piece that we're having this bottleneck approach. So some things that contributed to that on the paramedic front is COVID, right? It shut down the schools, and in particular community colleges. So for 2 years, those paramedic schools were shut down. They were legally not allowed to run schools. So there's been this two-year hiatus of no paramedic candidates popping out of school to then go get a job working for an ambulance company or our ambulance system or becoming firefighters. So those schools have been back up and running for about a year, but again, the most condensed school takes 9 months to get through. So we're right about that point where we're gonna start to see the market open up a little bit, and I got my fingers crossed that we're gonna be able to draw those candidates here. And it's this next academy we have scheduled for March of next year that will produce these people in September. And so hence my reason of, my goal is to fill those spots in September of next year. We might be able to squeak one or two out in between now and September, but we're just gonna have to really balance out what our abilities are with, you know, creating more vacancies. Because every time we make a promotion, we create a vacancy at the bottom. And that's the part where we are not struggling, we just have to manage it.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that the number of retirements you're getting in less years of experience, but it's probably helping a little bit with the budget.
Yes, I mean, we definitely are seeing an increase in retirements, which means we're losing our more tenured employees. But that's the other piece that when I pointed out to that our reflex time to fill a vacancy is 12 months, it's because it takes 5 months to get somebody through an academy. And the reason we're doing that is because we really need that turnkey firefighter, because we don't have, we're hiring so many people, their experience level, knowledge base is lower. So we're investing more on the front side with training to ensure that they're as prepared as they possibly can be, and then they can move up through the organization. And so with that, we are seeing a lot of, somebody mentioned, I forget who, but laterals. We're not really accepting laterals, like giving them a, hey, come work here, we'll give you a 2 week onboarding and then you can go hit the floor. We're not going that far, but we are seeing a lot of firefighters from other agencies raise their hand and go through a whole fire academy, go through a whole probationary period, and join our organization. So, what's that?
I'm sorry. That's great.
Yeah, it is good. It's a huge commitment because there's the potential. Like a 20-week academy, and you twist an ankle, and all of a sudden you can't complete the academy, and then what? So it's a pretty good risk, but people are still doing it.
And what percentage don't make it through?
We probably lose about 5 to 10%. And I would include that in our background process too. Hiring is tough. Individuals are making poor decisions, and so that shows up in their background. And sometimes we have to put the brakes on that and fail them out. So, yeah, between 5 and 10.
When do you expect the next two fire stations to be on board? Because that's gonna make a big change in that.
Yeah, and we're accounting for those vacancies and those needs. So like our next academy in March, that will feed the next fire station. Village 8 West is anticipated to open by January of 24. That requires 12 new employees. So that academy, we're looking to have 24 24 people show up to that academy. So it's definitely going to be one of our biggest. And then Bayfront is 1 year after that, so January 25. And then actually Bayfront's a double hit because there's an engine that's on the first year and then a truck company the second year. So that's 24 firefighters that we have to account for in the next 4 years, just on those, you know, to fill those holes by themselves.
I have your numbers. So this is, this copy I was able to pull up, it has all 11 positions in FY23, so this isn't exact. However, our FY23 estimated tax revenues are at $12.8 million, and our total fire department proposed expenditures are $10.5 million. So there's a $2.3 million gap there. And then granted, as we get closer to our 2032, it does close a bit down to closer to $1.3 million, but we do still have a solid buffer there. And plus, like he mentioned, it's, you know, as you have, you know, the younger captains promoting, generally some cost decrease in terms of PERS contributions, health insurance, depending on what they elect. So there was additional capacity there. And then like Chief was saying, it's sometimes these positions, there's a lag in adding them. So we are accounting for about an 8% salary savings for these vacancies. In reality, it's probably closer to 50, but for a conservative approach, we were using 8% in there.
Well, thank you for the very detailed presentation.
Yeah.
I definitely answers a lot of my questions. As far as the COC is concerned, I really believe that even though there's two civilian staff members being hired under this proposal, those are really relieving boots to be back on the ground and taking firefighters and putting them back in stations and on trucks and on engines. So you guys have my full support. I wish you the best of luck. I certainly can empathize with your staffing needs and issues because here in this building, we are experiencing the exact same thing. And we do take laterals, and we don't even have anybody applying for that job very often. So kudos to you guys, and I hope it works out, but you definitely have my support for it.
Does that sound like a motion?
It's a motion.
I second.
And a second. I have one question. I guess it's probably towards the manager's office. That is, the two civilian positions are, notwithstanding their level of specialization, from an organizational standpoint, does it make sense to have them embedded in the fire department?
Kelly Broughton, Deputy City Manager. We've actually had that discussion over the last couple of days as we've been talking about these positions, and that's still work in progress. I've been around government for now for almost 30 years. And seeing both methods, seeing specialization in individual departments, centralization in one corps serving those departments. And I think we're talking about something that kind of is in between, where the position is actually under the technical guidance of the IT department, but reports and works in the fire department so that they get their care and feeding and day-to-day activities from a technical perspective from the IT department, and fire says work on this today as they're, from an operational perspective. We're certainly going to be evaluating that as it goes along, but we have had that discussion, and it may end up being the position maybe in central IT, but with a more of a matrix structure as to how that person takes his day-to-day delivery. You always run into the situation where when you embed somebody in a department, they have a priority. They pull that resource and take it away from something that you want to do. That's something that we always have to be cautious about. And I know the chief and the IT department's manager have been very closely aligned on that discussion and understand that sensitivity. And so I think we'll be doing it thoughtfully and making a good decision on that one. And the chief can chime in on if he wants to.
But under any circumstances, the funding would be for Measure A for those two positions?
Yes.
And I guess just to add to that, one key thing I really want to emphasize, because I was spending a lot of time emphasizing this to the new IT director, we are not creating an IT department within the fire department, meaning this position's focus is not network-based. It's not to make the network, you know, really connect the fire department to the city. These are applications, software applications, all these vendors, and connecting the dots behind the scenes. And it's just, so essentially all, like,
I met with the IT director. There's only one of the 25 applications that they are actually supporting the fire department on. And in fact, in the next month or two, that one application is going to move out to the cloud and then be totally under contracted services. So really, this is not encroaching on, I think, that mission of our IT department. And yeah, we definitely don't want to create a rub, but we're actually seeing this as an opportunity, at least from my perspective, to help connect our departments better than it has been, and maybe see some additional support. You know, with if we have somebody that's working in our shop day in and day out, they can better communicate with the IT department and be able to communicate with them what our needs are and how to then bring it really under one roof. So the intent is to work better together.
Thank you for that. I think it's a great plan. I wholeheartedly endorse it. So we have a motion by Mr. Boozy.
Yes, sir.
Second by Mr. Guillen. Is there any further discussion? With that, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? There are none. The motion carries unanimously. Thank you. Next item, we have a presentation from the Neighborhood Protection Unit.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for your time, as always. I just wanted to update you since the last time I was here about what we've been doing in the Neighborhood Protection Unit. We're making good progress, and I'm happy to share what we've been doing. So, as always, our mission is to enhance the quality of life within the community by responding to community demands for safety and security, and to support the Chula Vista Police Department community policing efforts. And I was talking actually with the chief, asking how are things going, and it's like, you know, we're responsive to what's going on. So there's ebbs and flows, and like the cannabis issues, that was, you know, my day one priority. I'm not really working on that lately. I'm working on other things. So it's nice that I have the flexibility to kind of pivot and respond to what's coming up. And I think that was the whole purpose of having me on board, is to respond to things as they come up. So our three main focus areas are still criminal enforcement, gun violence restraining orders, and community engagement. In the area of criminal enforcement, the big update is short-term rental ordinance enactment. So that's gone into effect. The short-term rental ordinance was really to deal with these chronic issues of party houses that were being rented out day in and day out in all these residential neighborhoods with absentee owners that have no idea what's going on. They don't really care what's going on at their properties. They're just renting them out, making the money, and the neighborhood is suffering because of it. So the short-term rental ordinance put in a lot of rules and regulations about how you can rent out your house, how you can list it on Airbnb, VRBO, etc. And it was really impressive to see it be developed to deal with the problems that we were having in the community. Biggest thing is now it holds property owners accountable for what's happening on their property. So before, it was the person making the noise would get a noise citation, and then the next day it'd be a new person, and the next day it's a new person. This setup with the new short-term rental ordinance actually lets that noise violation to be issued to the owner, who's not on site, who's not there, but they are now being held responsible for what's happening at their property in this ordinance. So it's really great. There's a lot of different rules and things that you can and can't do in there. It gives the police department more tools to take action, because now they have different regulations for noise or parking, trash, etc., whatever's going on the property. And there's this follow-up after the fact of, okay, are we going to hold the property owner accountable for what happened? And the biggest thing, it also provides options for civil and criminal sanctions. So if something's, you know, de minimis or it's their first kind of run-in, they can get a civil citation. If it's something really serious, they can get a criminal citation, you know, like a misdemeanor ticket, have to come to court. One of their remedies is if the property owner has repeat offenses at their property, they can have their permit revoked and not be allowed to list their property on Airbnb, whatever hosting platform. So we're hoping that would be a really big deterrent and make property owners more invested in what's going on at their property and not just being absentee. In implementing this ordinance, I had the opportunity to present roll call training to the patrol officers. It was about the week right before 4th of July, which was great because I told them you're probably going to have a lot of these calls over the holiday weekend of problems going on. So I got to advise them on how to investigate these offenses, what's needed to prosecute them. All the officers were really interested and excited to have this and kind of a plan going forward of how to deal with these places. I'm also working with the police department on tobacco-related enforcement. The department recently received a grant to combat youth tobacco use. So I'm working with the detective in the Special Investigations Unit. We developed an enforcement strategy of how we're going to, you know, they have their metrics and what they have to do for their grants, so how it's going to play out on my side when they refer the cases to me. And basically it's holding businesses and licensees accountable to make sure they're not selling to minors. So I think that's a really good program for the city. It holds the businesses accountable, and of course we want to prevent minors using tobacco in the city. We're also working on different muni code updates. We're going through the muni code to make sure that sections are current and most importantly that they're enforceable. From my perspective as a prosecutor reading some of the statutes, it's either the language is a little vague or they're cumbersome or they're, you know, not applicable anymore. So we're going through and cleaning stuff up to make sure that it's as effective as possible. We're working particularly in the area of massage parlors. We're going to have basically a complete revamp of that whole section coming out soon. We're working on sign regulations, and this kind of goes into the second point about First Amendment issues, but going through to make sure that any muni codes that we have would survive any constitutional challenges. That kind of law is always changing, so you have to go back and look and see what you have to make sure that everything is current and up to date and just making sure it's as enforceable and effective as possible. In the area of gun violence restraining orders, I think last time I told you we were going to do a training and start implementing this. I think this area we've had the greatest progress in. So gun violence restraining orders are basically law enforcement recognizes there's a dangerous individual, whether they're violent, having a mental health crisis, drugs and alcohol, whatever is going on, that their access to firearms is creating a danger, that they're going to be more dangerous by that access to firearms. So basically they're issued a restraining order for a period of 1 to 5 years, the court orders it for 1 to 5 years, that they can't have any firearms or ammunition. So since October of 2021, we've obtained over 15 GVROs. We've had one with a school threat. He actually was 13 years old. There's no age limit for these. Just having a hard day and did some things and said some things that he shouldn't have. A lot of mental health crises, domestic violence, suicide threats. So it's being a danger to yourself and to others by having access to a firearm. And the police department has taken a lot of guns and a lot of bullets off the streets from dangerous individuals. So I'm really happy with the progress that we've been doing. And that program hopefully will keep continuing. We're working on a training actually for the district attorney's office. The district attorney's office doesn't have any standing or involvement in these proceedings. It's essentially the police department is applying for the orders and I appear as their attorney on their behalf, so the officers don't have to appear in court. I'm the one taking care of that for them and filing the paperwork. But we're gonna train the DA's office to let them know these are going on. They're gonna help us as an added layer screening cases that come through their office. If they think it might be a good candidate, they can refer them to us to screen. And because of my involvement in the GVROs, I've been working really closely with the gun desk and issues that come up with firearms. They ask me to research some things, you know, when people are asking to have their firearms returned to them, making sure that all the right steps are being taken and consulting with them. So that's been a really good development that I'm a resource to them on these kind of cases. And as always, we're still looking for opportunities for community engagement. I know we're particularly interested in the subject of fentanyl. It's really a big issue in the community, especially with the youth. So we're looking at potential programs, you know, in schools, working with the district attorney's office, educating on fentanyl and the dangers of fentanyl. So. Questions, ideas, thoughts?
I have one for you. So did some of the ideas of the short-term rentals come from like Orlando, Florida, where they're having such major problems around Disney World?
I don't know if it's specifically from Orlando, Florida, but I know we looked at many different cities, many different communities, but I mean, it was the Muni Code. What's great about it is it's crafted specifically for what our needs and requirements are to preserve our community. What are the kind of complaints that we're getting on the civil side of things? You know, there's regulations and requirements for insurance, fire, electrical, building to make sure that these places that are being rented out are safe, that there's no illegal construction, stuff like that.
And are HOA presidents and boards being made aware of all this? Because a lot of times that's what's happening in HOA situations. Because we were having that in La Jolla when I was the president up there.
I feel like you're on the board of something everywhere.
I'm sorry.
That's awesome.
I sat on them all. I'm like,
no, that's
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I don't know about the specific tie with HOAs, but I know that DSD is working on an education campaign for property owners that are renting them out. And then I also suggested, why don't we do other community meetings for neighbors and, you know, just residents to know, okay, if my neighbor has one of these rentals, what's expected of them? What's reasonable for me to complain about? What kind of response should I expect? Things like that. Yes.
So I know it's going to be a weird comparison, but obviously on the short-term rentals, that's for Chula Vista only.
Yeah.
And for the GVROs, that's for the state of California?
So the GVROs, it is the penal code, so they're state laws, but I'm only working with the Chula Vista Police Department.
So is that data used throughout, so if someone doesn't try to buy a gun?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it goes into the CLETS, it's the California Law Enforcement Teletype System. So it gets entered by the Sheriff's Department, and it is statewide, yeah.
That's how we base our decisions on permitting for those businesses that have been operating. We get those complaints, our regulations preclude you from applying for short-term rentals in certain circumstances for violations.
For
certain violations.
Yeah, so that prevents them from owning, possessing, purchasing.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Any other business? Any staff comments?
Yes, Chair Stuckey, just one comment from the police department. So I just wanted to just make sure that all the committee and all the commission members were aware. As between the last couple of meetings and today, the police chief's recommended appointee to the commission. Gary Focacci has gone on the Reno Pastures. He's gallivanting around somewhere in some sunny side, probably riding his motorcycle and enjoying retirement. But in the time since, the police chief has recommended and since has been appointed Vern Salute to the commission as well. Although Vern could not be here at the particular commission meeting, I wanted to make sure that the commission members were aware of that appointment. And Vern was a former captain here, retired a while ago. A tremendous amount of obviously experience in the needs and some of the nuances and complexities of running a professional community-based police organization. So I think he's going to be great. I know he's going to be a great addition to the commission. And,
thank you. Back row. Okay. I have only one comment. Thank you for your confidence expressed by so I can be the U.S. Chairman. I appreciate that. I look forward to a fruitful and productive year. Anybody else? Comments? Seeing none. We are now adjourned until the next meeting.